Particles of plutonium had bonded with metal and plastic debris, mixed with jet fuel, water, and ice. Plutonium had risen in the smoke from the fire and traveled through the air for miles. The one-point safety tests of the Mark 28's core, performed secretly at Los Alamos during the Eisenhower administration, had been money well spent. If the Mark 28 hadn't been made inherently one-point safe, the bombs that hit the ice could have produced a nuclear yield. And the partial detonation of a nuclear weapon, or two, or three, without any warning, at the air base considered essential for the defense of the United States, could have been misinterpreted at SAC headquarters. Nobody expected the Thule monitor to destroy Thule. Instead, the Air Force had to confront a less dangerous yet challenging problem: how to decontaminate about 3 square miles of ice, about 700 miles north of the Arctic Circle, during the middle of winter, in the dark. Generators, floodlights, a helicopter pad, sleds, tracked vehicles, and half a dozen prefabricated buildings were brought to the crash site. New roads from the base were cut through the snow. A hotline was drawn around the contaminated area, with restrictions on who could enter it and decontamination control points for everyone who left it. Once again, hundreds of young airmen walked shoulder to shoulder, looking for bomb parts and pieces of a B-52. Most of the debris was small, ranging from the size of a dime to that of a cigarette pack. Some of it had fallen through a gash in the ice, cut by the crash, that later refroze. The ice was about 2 feet thick, the water below it 600 feet deep. Pieces of the bomb and the plane were carried away by the current or settled on the bottom of Bylot Sound. Arctic storms with high winds complicated the recovery and cleanup efforts, spreading plutonium dust and hiding it beneath the snow. But the levels of contamination were more accurately measured at Thule than at Palomares. A new device, the Field Instrument for the Detection of Low-Energy Radiation, Fiddler, looked for the X-rays and gamma rays emitted by plutonium instead of the alpha particles. Those rays traveled a longer distance and passed through snow. Over the next 8 months, the top 2 inches of the blackened ice within the hotline were removed, trucked to the base, condensed, packed in containers, shipped to Charleston, South Carolina, and then transported by rail to the AEC facility in Aiken. The radioactive waste from Thule filled 147 freight cars. During the summer of 1968, after Bylot Sound thawed, a Navy submersible searched for part of a Mark 28 bomb. The plutonium cores of the primaries in all 4 weapons had been blown to bits, and most of the uranium from their secondaries had been recovered. But a crucial piece of one bomb was still missing, most likely the enriched uranium spark plug necessary for a thermonuclear blast. It was never found, and the search later inspired erroneous claims that an entire hydrogen bomb had been lost beneath the ice. The Air Force did a much better job of handling the press coverage at Thule than at Palomares. It helped that the B-52 had crashed near one of the most remote military installations in the world, far from any cities, towns, or tourists. An accident that contaminated 3 square miles of a large metropolitan area would have gained more attention. The Air Force admitted from the outset that nuclear weapons had been involved in the crash. Dozens of journalists were flown to Thule within days of the accident and supplied with a good deal of information. Few had the desire to remain in the Arctic for long, and a couple of other news stories, the seizure of the USS Pueblo by North Korea and the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, quickly pushed Thule off the front page. The Air Force account of the accident, however, was deliberately misleading. Denmark had imposed a strict ban on nuclear weapons, and its NATO allies were forbidden to bring them into Danish territory or airspace. For more than a decade, the Strategic Air Command had routinely violated that prohibition at Thule. The B-52 that crashed onto the ice, the Pentagon told reporters, had been on a training flight and had radioed that it was preparing to make an emergency landing. A handful of people within the Danish government and its military were no doubt aware that B-52s had been flying nuclear weapons over Danish territory every day for almost 7 years. But they may not have known that atomic bombs were stored in secret underground bunkers at Thule as early as 1955. Hydrogen bombs were deployed there the following year. Before the introduction of SAC's airborne alert, Thule was a convenient spot for bombers to land, refuel, and pick up their weapons en route to the Soviet Union. The early hydrogen bombs were so heavy that pre-positioning them in Greenland would allow SAC's planes to make the long round-trip flight to Russia over the North Pole. Dozens of anti-aircraft missiles with atomic warheads were later placed at Thule to defend the base from a Soviet attack. But none of these facts were shared with the Danish people. The airborne alert program was terminated the day after the Thule accident. The risks no longer seemed justifiable, and many B-52s were now being used to bomb Vietnam. SAC's ground alert was unaffected by the new policy. Hundreds of planes loaded with hydrogen bombs still sat beside runways all over the United States, ready to take off within minutes. And a B-52 secretly continued to fly back and forth above Thule day and night without nuclear weapons, just to make sure it was still there. 23 years after Sandia became a separate laboratory, it created a nuclear weapons safety department. An assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Atomic Energy, Carl Walski, was concerned about the risks of nuclear accidents. He had traveled to Denmark, dealt with the aftermath of the Thule accident, and come to believe that the safety standards of the weapons labs were based on a questionable use of statistics. Before a nuclear weapon could enter the stockpile, the odds of its accidental detonation had to be specified, along with its other military characteristics. Those odds were usually said to be 1 in 1,000,000 during storage, transportation, and handling. But the dimensions of that probability were rarely defined. Was the risk 1 in 1,000,000 for a single weapon or for an entire weapon system? Was it 1 in 1,000,000 per year or throughout the operational life of a weapon? How the risk was defined made a big difference at a time when the United States had about 30,000 nuclear weapons. The permissible risk of an American nuclear weapon detonating inadvertently could range from 1 in 1,000,000 to 1 in 20,000, depending on when the statistical parameters were set. Walski issued new safety standards in March 1968. They said that the probability of a premature nuclear detonation should be no greater than 1 in 1,000,000,000 amid normal storage and operational environments during the lifetime of a single weapon. And the probability of a detonation amid abnormal environments should be no greater than 1 in 1,000,000. An abnormal environment could be anything from the heat of a burning airplane to the water pressure inside a sinking submarine. Walski's safety standards applied to every nuclear weapon in the American stockpile. They demanded a high level of certainty that an accidental detonation could never occur. But they offered no guidelines on how these strict criteria could be met. And in the memo announcing the new policy, Walski expressed confidence that the adoption of the attached standards will not result in any increase in weapon development times or costs. A few months later, William L. Stevens was chosen to head Sandia's new nuclear safety department. Stevens had earned a degree in electrical engineering at Virginia Polytechnic Institute, served as an officer in the Army, and spent a few years in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, working for an oil company. He joined Sandia in 1957 at the age of 28. Bob Purifoy had hired him, and the two worked together on the electrical system of the W-49 warhead, the first one to contain a trajectory sensing switch as a safety device. When Stevens was assigned to lead the new safety department, he wasn't convinced that nuclear weapon accidents posed a grave threat to the United States, but he'd been closer to a nuclear detonation than most scientific observers, and seen firsthand how unpredictable one could be. While serving in the Army, Stevens had been trained to assemble the warheads of tactical weapon systems. In May 1953, members of his battalion participated in the test of an atomic cannon. Its shells could travel 20 miles and produce a yield equivalent to that of the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. For the test in the Nevada desert, all sorts of things were placed near Ground Zero to study the weapon's effects. Trucks, tanks, railroad cars, aircraft panels, oil drums and cans of gasoline, household goods and materials, denim, flannel, rayon curtains, mops and brooms, a one-story brick structure, steel bridges, buildings that resembled motels, 100 tall pine trees, field crops, flowers, insects, cages full of rats and mice, 56 dogs tethered inside aluminum tubes, 42 pigs dressed in U.S. Army uniforms whose skin would respond to thermal radiation in a manner similar to that of human skin, and more than 3,000 soldiers, including Bill Stevens, who huddled in a trench about 3 miles from Ground Zero. The troops were part of an ongoing study of the psychological effects of nuclear warfare. They'd been ordered to climb out of their trenches and march toward the mushroom cloud after the blast. The Army Field Forces Human Research Unit hoped to discover how well they would follow the order, whether they'd obey it or come unglued at the sight of a large nuclear explosion. The atomic shell would fly directly over the heads of Stevens and the other soldiers. They were told to crouch in their trenches until the weapon detonated, then rise in time to brace against the blast wave and watch the explosion. At 8:30 in the morning, a great fireball lit up the desert, about 90 miles from Las Vegas. As the troops stood, a powerful shockwave blew past, catching them by surprise. It was a precursor wave, a weapon effect that hadn't been predicted. Highly compressed air had come down from the fireball, hit the ground, and spread outward, traveling faster than the blast wave. When Stevens and his unit climbed from the trenches to march toward Ground Zero, they were engulfed by a cloud of dirt and dust. Their lead officer couldn't read the radiation dosage markers and led them closer to Ground Zero than planned. After returning to their base in Albuquerque, Stevens shook the dirt out of his uniform and saved some of it in a can. 20 years later, he had the dirt tested at Sandia, and it was still radioactive. After becoming the head of the Nuclear Safety Department at the lab, Stevens looked through the accident reports kept by the Defense Atomic Support Agency, the Pentagon group that had replaced the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project. The military now used Native American terminology to categorize nuclear weapon accidents. The loss, theft, or seizure of a weapon was an empty quiver. Damage to a weapon, without any harm to the public or risk of detonation, was a bent spear. And an accident that caused the unauthorized launch or jettison of a weapon, a fire, an explosion, a release of radioactivity, or a full-scale detonation was a broken arrow. The official list of nuclear accidents, compiled by the Department of Defense and the AEC, included 13 broken arrows. Bill Stevens read reports that secretly described a much larger number of unusual events with nuclear weapons, and a study of abnormal environments commissioned by Sandia soon found that at least 1,200 nuclear weapons had been involved in significant incidents and accidents between 1950 and March 1968. The armed services had done a poor job of reporting nuclear weapon accidents until 1959, and subsequently reported about 130 a year. Many of the accidents were minor. During loading of a Mark 25 Mod OWR warhead onto a 6x6 truck, a handler lost his balance. The unit tipped and fell approximately 4 feet from the truck to the pavement. And some were not. A C-124 aircraft carrying 8 Mark 28 War Reserve warheads and 1 Mark 49 Y-2 Mod 3 War Reserve warhead was struck by lightning. Observers noted a large ball of fire pass through the aircraft from nose to tail. The ball of fire was accompanied by a loud noise. Reading these accident reports persuaded Stevens that the safety of America's nuclear weapons couldn't be assumed. The available data was insufficient for making accurate predictions about the future. 1,000 weapon accidents were not enough for any reliable calculation of the odds. 23 weapons had been directly exposed to fires during an accident without detonating. Did that prove a fire couldn't detonate a nuclear weapon? Or would the 24th exposure produce a blinding white flash and a mushroom cloud? The one-in-a-million assurances that Sandia had made for years now seemed questionable. They'd been made without much empirical evidence. Instead of basing weapons safety on probabilistic estimates, Stevens wanted to ground it in a thorough understanding of abnormal environments and how the components of a nuclear weapon would behave in them. During a single accident, a weapon might be crushed, burned, and struck by debris at a wide range of temperatures and velocities. The interplay among those factors was almost impossible to quantify or predict, and no two accidents would ever be exactly the same. But he thought that good engineering could invent safety devices that would always respond predictably. Bill Stevens hired 6 staff members to explore how to make nuclear weapons safer. Stan Spray was one of the first Sandia engineers to be recruited, and he soon led the research on abnormal environments. Spray had been concerned about weapon safety for years. While visiting the Naval Ordnance Test Station near Cape Canaveral, Florida, he'd watched a bent pin nearly detonate an atomic bomb during a routine test. The accident could have obliterated a large stretch of the Florida coast. In the early 1960s, Spray investigated a series of electrical faults in nuclear weapons, analyzing more than 12 anomalous events prompted by crashes, handling mistakes, and design errors. He had a rare ability to focus intently on a problem for hours, to the exclusion of almost everything around him, until it was solved. Spray and his team began to gather components from existing weapons and subject them to every kind of abuse that might be encountered in an abnormal environment. It helped that Sandia had the world's largest lightning simulator. Ever since Donald Hornig babysat the first nuclear device during a lightning storm the night before the Trinity test, various forms of electromagnetic radiation had been considered a potential trigger of accidental detonations. The Navy tested many of its weapons by placing them, unarmed, on the deck of an aircraft carrier, turning on all the ship's radars and communications equipment, and waiting to see if anything happened. The electro-explosive squibs of a Navy missile detonated during one of those shipboard tests, and similar squibs were used in some nuclear weapons. By 1968, at least 70 missiles with nuclear warheads had already been involved in lightning accidents. Lightning had struck a fence at a MACE medium-range missile complex, traveled more than 100 yards along the fence, damaged 3 of the 8 missiles, and knocked out the power to the site. Each missile carried a Mark 28 thermonuclear warhead. 4 Jupiter missiles in Italy had also been hit by lightning. Some of their thermal batteries fired, and in 2 of the warheads, tritium gas was released into their cores, ready to boost a nuclear detonation. The weapons weren't designed to sit atop missiles, exposed to the elements for days at a time. They lacked safety mechanisms to protect against lightning strikes. Instead of removing the warheads or putting safety devices inside them, the Air Force surrounded its Jupiter sites with tall metal towers to draw lightning away from the missiles. Stan Spray's group ruthlessly burned, scorched, baked, crushed, and tortured weapon components to find their potential flaws. And in the process, Spray helped to overturn the traditional thinking about electrical circuits at Sandia. It had always been taken for granted that if 2 circuits were kept physically apart, if they weren't mated or connected in any way, like separate power lines running beside a highway, current couldn't travel from one to the other. In a normal environment, that might be true. But strange things began to happen when extreme heat and stress were applied. When circuit boards were bent or crushed, circuits that were supposed to be kept far apart might suddenly meet. The charring of a circuit board could transform its fiberglass from an insulator into a conductor of electricity. The solder of a heat-sensitive fuse was supposed to melt when it reached a certain temperature, blocking the passage of current during a fire. But Spray discovered that solder behaved oddly once it melted. As a liquid, it could prevent an electrical connection, or flow back into its original place, reconnect wires, and allow current to travel between them. The unpredictable behavior of materials and electrical circuits during an accident was compounded by the design of most nuclear weapons. Although fission and fusion were radically new and destructive forces in warfare, the interior layout of bombs hadn't changed a great deal since the Second World War. The wires from different components still met in a single junction box. Wiring that armed the bomb and wiring that prevented it from being armed often passed through the same junction, making it possible for current to jump from one to the other. And the safety devices were often located far from the bomb's firing set. The greater the distance between them, Spray realized, the greater the risk that stray electricity could somehow enter an arming line, set off the detonators, and cause a nuclear explosion. By 1970, the Nuclear Safety Department had come up with an entirely new approach to preventing accidental nuclear detonations. Three basic safety principles had been derived from its research, and each would be assured by a different mechanism or component inside a weapon. The first principle was incompatibility. There had to be a unique arming signal that couldn't be sent by a short circuit or a stray wire. The second principle was isolation. The firing set and the detonators had to be protected behind a physical barrier that would exclude fire, electricity, and electromagnetic energy, that couldn't be easily breached, and that would allow only the unique arming signal to enter it. The third principle was inoperability. The firing set had to contain a part that would predictably and irreversibly fail in an abnormal environment. That part was called a weak link. The hardened barrier was called a strong link, and combined with a unique arming signal, they promised a level of nuclear weapons safety that would meet or exceed Wolski's 1-in-a-million standard. Another Sandia safety effort was being concluded at roughly the same time. Project Crescent had set out to design a super-safe bomb, one that wouldn't detonate under any conceivable set of accident conditions or spread plutonium, even after being mistakenly dropped from an altitude of 40,000 feet. At first, the Air Force was less than enthusiastic about requiring more safety in nuclear weapons, according to a classified memo on the project. But the Air Force eventually warmed to the idea. A super-safe bomb might permit the resumption of the Strategic Air Command's airborne alert. After more than 2 years of research, Project Crescent proposed a weapon design that, like a concept car at an automobile show, was innovative but impractical. To prevent the high explosives from detonating and scattering plutonium after a plane crash, the bomb would have a thick casing and a lot of interior padding. Those features would make it 3 to 4 times heavier than most hydrogen bombs. The additional weight would reduce the number of nuclear weapons that a B-52 could carry. And that's why the super-safe bomb was never built. Bob Purifoy became the director of weapon development at Sandia, Albuquerque in September 1973. He'd closely followed the work of engineers in the safety department and shared many of their frustrations with the bureaucratic mindset at the lab. Nothing had been done about the problems that they'd discovered. Bill Stevens had traveled to Washington, D.C. 3 years earlier, briefed the Military Liaison Committee to the AEC on the dangers of abnormal environments, and described the weak link, strong link technology that could minimize them. The committee took no action. The Department of Defense was preoccupied with the war in Vietnam. A broken arrow hadn't occurred since Thule, and a familiar complacency once again settled upon the whole issue of nuclear weapon safety. After taking the new job, Purifoy made a point of reading the classified reports on every broken arrow and major weapon accident, a lengthy catalog of fires, crashes, and explosions, of near misses and disasters narrowly averted. The fact that an accidental detonation had not yet happened, that a major city had not yet been blanketed with plutonium, offered little comfort. The probabilities remained unknown. What were the odds of a screwdriver used to repair an alarm system launching the warhead off a missile? The odds of a rubber seat cushion bringing down a B-52? After reading through the accident reports, Purifoy reached his own conclusion about the safety of America's nuclear weapons. We are living on borrowed time. Purifoy had recently heard about an explosive called 135-triamino-246-trinitrobenzene, TATB. It had been invented in 1888, but had been rarely used since then, because TATB was so hard to detonate. Under federal law, it wasn't even classified as an explosive. It was considered a flammable solid. With the right detonators, however, it could produce a shockwave almost as strong as the high explosives that surrounded the core of a nuclear weapon. TATB soon became known as an insensitive high explosive. You could drop it, hammer it, set it on fire, smash it into the ground at a speed of 1,500 feet per second, and it still wouldn't detonate. The explosives being used in America's nuclear weapons would go off from an impact one-tenth as strong. Harold Agnew was now the director of Los Alamos, and he thought using TATB and hydrogen bombs made a lot more sense as a means of preventing plutonium dispersal during an accident than adding 2,000 or 3,000 extra pounds of steel and padding. All the necessary elements for nuclear weapons safety were now available: a unique signal, weak link, strong link technology, insensitive high explosives. The only thing missing was the willingness to fight a bureaucratic war on their behalf. And Bob Purifoy had that quality in abundance. He was no longer a low-level employee toiling away on the electrical system of a bomb without a sense of the bigger picture. As the head of weapon development, he now had some authority to make policy at Sandia, and he planned to take advantage of it. 3 months into the new job, Purifoy told his superior, Glenn Fowler, a vice president at the lab, that all the nuclear weapons carried by aircraft had to be retrofitted with new safety devices. Purifoy didn't claim that the weapons were unsafe. He said their safety could no longer be presumed. Fowler listened carefully to his arguments and agreed. A briefing for Sandia's upper management was scheduled for February 1974. The briefing did not go well. The other vice presidents at Sandia were indifferent, unconvinced, or actively hostile to Purifoy's recommendations. The strongest opponents of a retrofit argued that it would harm the lab's reputation. It would imply that Sandia had been wrong about nuclear weapons safety for years. They said new weapons with improved safety features could eventually replace the old ones, and they made clear that the lab's research and development money would not be spent on bombs already in the stockpile. Sandia couldn't force the armed services to alter their weapons, and the Department of Defense had the ultimate responsibility for nuclear weapon safety. The lab's upper management said essentially that this was someone else's problem. In April 1974, Purifoy and Fowler went to Washington and met with Major General Ernest Graves, Jr., a top official at the Atomic Energy Commission, whose responsibilities included weapon safety. Sandia reported to the AEC, and Purifoy was aiming higher on the bureaucratic ladder. Graves listened to the presentation and then did nothing about it. 5 months later, unwilling to let the issue drop and ready to escalate the battle, Purifoy and Fowler put their concerns on the record. A letter to General Graves was drafted, and Glenn Fowler placed his career at risk by signing and sending it. The Fowler letter, as it was soon called, caused a top-secret uproar in the nuclear weapon community. It ensured that high-level officials at the weapons labs, the AEC, and the Pentagon couldn't hide behind claims of plausible deniability if a serious accident happened. The letter was proof that they had been warned. Most of the aircraft-delivered weapons now in stockpile were designed to requirements which envisioned operations consisting mostly of long periods of igloo storage and some brief exposure to transportation environments, the Fowler letter began. But these weapons were now being used in ways that could subject them to abnormal environments, and none of the weapons had adequate safety mechanisms. Fowler described the possibility of these safing devices being electrically bypassed through charred organic plastics or melted solder, and warned of their premature operation from stray voltages and currents. He listed the weapons that should immediately be retrofitted or retired, including the Genie, the Hound Dog, the 9-megaton Mark 53 bomb, and the weapons that needed to be replaced, notably the Mark 28. SAC's most widely deployed bomb. He said that the Secretary of Defense should be told about the risks of using these weapons during ground alerts. And Fowler recommended, due to the urgency associated with the safety question, that nuclear weapons should be loaded onto aircraft only for missions absolutely required for national security reasons. The scope of the Fowler letter had deliberately been limited to the weapons whose safety devices were Sandia's responsibility, mainly bombs carried by airplanes. The Army, the Navy, and the Air Force were responsible for the arming and fusing mechanisms of the nuclear warheads carried by their missiles. And the safety of those warheads in an abnormal environment was even more questionable than the safety of the bombs. The batteries, accelerometers, barometric switches, and safety devices weren't located inside the warhead of a ballistic missile. They were in an adaptation kit a few feet beneath it, which meant the arming wires traveled a good distance to the detonators. That distance made it easier for stray voltage to enter the wires, and the missile was constantly linked to sources of electrical power inside the silo. In 1974, the oldest nuclear warhead deployed on a ballistic missile was also the most powerful, the W-53 atop the Titan II, designed in the late 1950s. Tucked away inside a silo, the W-53 was less likely to encounter abnormal environments than a bomb. But how the warhead would respond to them was less clearly understood. Part 5. Damascus. Balanced and Unbalanced. During the summer of 1979, James L. Skip Rutherford III was working in the Little Rock office of Senator David H. Pryor. Rutherford was 29 years old. He'd grown up in Batesville, Arkansas, a small town in the northern part of the state, attended the University of Arkansas, and edited the student newspaper there. After graduation, he did public relations work for a bank in Fayetteville. The job introduced him to Pryor, who was running for a seat in the United States Senate after 2 terms as the governor of Arkansas. Pryor was a new breed of Southern Democrat, an opponent of racism and segregation, a supporter of women's rights, a progressive who greatly enjoyed meeting with voters, rich or poor, in every corner of the state. Rutherford worked as a volunteer for the campaign and joined Pryor's staff after the election, representing the senator at events throughout Arkansas. And then one day Rutherford took a call from someone at Little Rock Air Force Base, a young airman who wanted to meet with Pryor confidentially. The airman sounded nervous. When Rutherford asked what this was about, the airman said, "It's about the Titan missiles." Skip Rutherford didn't consider himself an expert on intercontinental ballistic missiles, but he'd served in the Arkansas Air National Guard for 6 years, spending 1 weekend a month at Little Rock Air Force Base. He knew a lot of people at the base and felt comfortable there. The airman agreed to meet with Rutherford at the federal building in Little Rock after hours to avoid being seen, and brought a couple of other guys who worked with the Titan II. They were about Rutherford's age. They didn't want their names used as the source of any information. They were scared about getting into trouble. And most of all, they were scared about what was happening at the Titan II silos in Arkansas. The missiles were old, the airman said, and most of them leaked. The portable vapor detectors and the vapor detectors in the silos often didn't work. Spare parts were hard to find. The propellant transfer system crews were overworked, sometimes spending 15 or 16 hours on the job. And many of the young PTS technicians weren't adequately trained for the tasks they were being ordered to perform. After that first meeting, Rutherford secretly met with other airmen from the base and took their calls from payphones late at night. He spoke to roughly a dozen members of the 308th Strategic Missile Wing, promising not to reveal their identities to the Air Force. And they all said basically the same thing. The Titan II was a disaster waiting to happen. Rutherford told Senator Pryor about the meetings. Pryor was disturbed by the information and decided that something had to be done. He wrote to Dr. Hans S. Mark, the Secretary of the Air Force, asking for details about the staff shortages and training deficiencies at Little Rock Air Force Base. And Pryor learned that other members of Congress were concerned about the Titan II. Representative Dan Glickman, a Democrat, and Senator Bob Dole, a Republican, had already asked the Air Force to launch a formal investigation of safety problems with the Titan II. Glickman and Dole were both from Kansas, where some of the missile's flaws had been revealed during an accident the previous summer. At Launch Complex 533-7, about an hour southeast of Wichita, Kansas, the final stages of a missile recycle were being completed. A Titan II had been removed from 3-7 and returned to McConnell Air Force Base, where it would undergo routine maintenance checks. A replacement missile had been lowered into the silo. On the morning of August 24, 1978, a PTS crew arrived at the complex to pump oxidizer into the tanks. The fuel would be added the following day, and then the warhead would be placed atop the Titan II, finishing the recycle. On the main floor of the control center, the head of the PTS crew, Staff Sergeant Robert J. Thomas, briefed the Missile Combat Crew Commander, First Lieutenant Keith E. Matthews, about the work that would be done that day. A trainee, Airman Merle Linthicum, would be acting as PTS team chief, supervising the procedure from the control trailer topside. Oxidizer lines were attached to the Stage 1 and Stage 2 tanks, and both were full in about an hour. The lines were thick, heavy hoses through which the propellant flowed. Airman Irby Hepstall and Airman Carl Malinger put on REFCO suits and entered the silo to disconnect the lines. Malinger had never been inside a Titan II silo before. He was 19 years old and new to the Air Force, accompanying Hepstall that day for on-the-job training. The removal of the Stage 2 lines near the top of the missile went smoothly. Hepstall and Malinger rode the elevator down to disconnect the lines from Stage 1. Standing on a platform near the bottom of the missile, they unscrewed one of them. A powerful stream of oxidizer, like water suddenly released from a fire hydrant, hit Malinger's chest and the faceplate of his helmet and knocked him down. Hepstall tried to reconnect the line, but it wouldn't screw back on. Oxidizer poured from the missile, fell into the W below it, and then rose as a thick, reddish-brown cloud of vapor. Inside the top level of the control center, Lieutenant Matthews was preparing his lunch when a klaxon sounded. Down below, the deputy commander, Second Lieutenant Charles B. Frost, sat at the launch control console. Frost wore a headset and monitored the PTS team on the radio. He pushed a button on the console and turned off the klaxon, assuming that a puff of oxidizer had set it off when the lines were disconnected. That happened all the time. The klaxon sounded again, and Frost heard screams over the radio. "Oh my God, the poppet!" "What was the poppet?" Frost said into his headset. "What's wrong?" Matthews came down the stairs as warning lights flashed on the console. Oxy vapor launch duct, vapor silo equip area, vapor oxy pump room. "Get out of here! Let's get out!" a voice yelled over the radio. "Where are you?" Frost asked. The sounds on the radio were chaotic. People were talking at the same time. They were shouting and screaming and drowning one another out. Frost pushed the override button, blocking everybody else's radio transmission, and ordered, "Come back to the control center." "I can't see," somebody said. Lieutenant Matthews walked over to the blast door protecting the control center. He tried to open the door and see what was going on. The blast door wouldn't open. And Matthews got a whiff of something that smelled a lot like Clorox bleach. It smelled like oxidizer. In the control trailer topside, Airman Linthicum, the trainee running his first recycle, heard the shouting on the radio but couldn't understand what was being said. Linthicum ran out of the trailer, trying to get better reception on a portable headset, and saw a reddish cloud rising from the exhaust vents. Another member of the PTS crew left the trailer, found Sergeant Thomas, the most experienced technician at the site, and told him something had gone wrong. Thomas was 29 years old. He saw the oxidizer, ran to the access portal, and asked the control center for permission to enter the launch complex. Lieutenant Frost granted the permission, unlocking the outer steel door for Thomas and then the door at the bottom of the entrapment area. All the hazard lights on Frost's console seemed to be flashing at once, including fuel vapor launch duct, which made no sense. Frost kept asking the PTS team chief where they were in the checklist when the accident happened, hoping to find the right emergency checklist for dealing with it. But the radio still didn't work properly. Frost pulled out different tech manuals and flipped through their pages. He wasn't sure what they were supposed to do. "Hey, I smell Clorox," Matthews said. He told the missile crew to set up a portable vapor detector in front of the door to close the blast valve and the blast damper, protecting the air supply of the control center. The missile facilities technician, Senior Airman Glenn H. Wessel, placed a vapor detector near the blast door. He could smell oxidizer. The detector quickly registered 1 to 3 parts per million. Somehow the stuff was getting into the control center. Wessel told his commander that the room was being contaminated with oxidizer. They both tried to open the blast door, but it wouldn't budge. The crew was locked inside the control center. The two PTS technicians waiting in the blast block, serving as backup, had no idea what was happening in the silo. They could hear screams on the radio, but nobody would answer them. And then the door from the long cableway suddenly swung open, and Hepstall appeared. Oxidizer had turned the faceplate of his helmet white. It was so opaque, you couldn't see his face. Hepstall pulled off the helmet. He was sobbing. He said, "Malinger's still down there. We have to go and get him out. If anything happens to Malinger," he said, "I'll never forgive myself." Hepstall had left his trainee in the silo amid a thick cloud of oxidizer, found his way to the elevator, and ridden it 5 levels to the long cableway. The door to the blast lock opened, and Sergeant Thomas walked inside. He saw Hepstall sobbing, heard that Malinger was missing, and put on one of the backup team's Refco suits. Without a moment's hesitation, Thomas had decided to search for Malinger. Hepstall offered to go with him and grabbed a fresh helmet. Wearing the Refcos, they opened the door and headed down the long cableway toward the silo. The air was becoming thick with oxidizer. The PTS backup team waited anxiously in the blast lock. Moments later, the door swung open. Hepstall stumbled inside and fell to the ground, coughing. He hadn't made it very far. The new helmet leaked, and oxidizer was getting into his Refco. Hepstall took off the suit, got into another one, and left for the silo again. On the bottom floor of the control center, Wessel was amazed by how hard it was to open the escape hatch. The ratchet that you needed to use felt really heavy. He and the ballistic missile analyst technician, Danford M. Wong, took turns with it, wearing their gas masks. They were highly motivated. The blast door still wouldn't open, and this looked like their only way out. Lieutenant Frost was still attempting, without success, to reach the PTS team in the silo, Sergeant Thomas, and the PTS guys in the trailer, using the telephone and the radio. It wasn't easy with a gas mask on. Frost would pull off the mask momentarily, speak, put the mask back on, and listened for some response. Nobody answered him. And then, clear as a bell, he heard Malinger shouting over the radio, "My God, help us, help us, we need help. Hey, door 8 is locked, we're locked in, you guys get out," Frost told him. Malinger kept repeating that he needed help, and Frost tried to make him understand that the blast door was stuck. The emergency phone rang and Frost answered it. Someone was outside blast door 8 asking for help. "Hey, you guys, get out of here. Get out of here now," Frost said. "Just get out. Door 8 is locked, so you guys get out." Wessel and Wong could hear the commotion on the floor above them and cranked the ratchet on the escape hatch as fast as they could. Blast door 8 swung open, and Malinger ran into the control center carrying his helmet, yelling that Sergeant Thomas was dead. A cloud of oxidizer followed him, and then Hepstall came in without a helmet and collapsed onto the floor. He landed near the stairs as Malinger kept screaming. None of it made sense to the missile crew. Commander Matthews said, "Come help me," to Frost, and they entered the blast lock. Sergeant Thomas lay unconscious on the floor. They picked him up, carried him into the control center, and shut the door. Thomas was having convulsions, his head nodding side to side in the Refco helmet. Malinger took off the helmet and started to give him mouth to mouth. "This is 3-7, Frost told the command post at McConnell Air Force Base. "The locks are on the safe and the keys are in it. We got one man possibly down and we're evacuating now." Thomas died on the floor, staring at the ceiling. "Where's the Dep? Where's the Dep?" Wessel shouted, calling for Frost, their deputy commander. They were getting tired, and they needed his help to open the escape hatch. The light grew dimmer as the control center filled with oxidizer. Malinger didn't want to leave Thomas behind. It seemed wrong. After getting knocked down by the powerful stream of oxidizer, Malinger had gotten lost in the silo near the base of the missile, unable to see more than a few feet, unaware that Hepstall had taken the elevator and left him down there. Sergeant Thomas had found him and brought him out, and now Malinger didn't want to leave Thomas on the floor. "We'll get him later," Frost said, heading downstairs to work on the hatch. Matthews helped Malinger and Hepstall down the stairs and then helped them take off their Refco suits. They said their skin was burning. "My God, please help me," Hepstall said. "It's in here with me. It's with me." Matthews went back upstairs and checked the other two levels of the control center, looking for stragglers just in case. The cloud of oxidizer was now so thick that he couldn't see more than 2 or 3 feet ahead. The escape hatch was open, finally. Wessel went into it first, crawled through the tunnel, and climbed the ladder as fast as he could. It felt like climbing up a chimney full of smoke as the oxidizer filled the narrow air shaft. At the top, Wessel pulled the pins and then pushed the metal grating open with his head. Wong was right behind him, and then Frost, who'd paused every few rungs to pull Hepstall up the ladder. Frost wanted to help him, and didn't want him falling onto Malinger. Lieutenant Matthews went last, closing the hatch behind him to trap the oxidizer in the control center. The missile crew carried the two injured PTS technicians to the emergency showers on the hard stand to rinse them off. The showers didn't work. "Get them under the fire hydrant," Matthews said. The crew put Hepstall and Malinger in front of the hydrant and turned it on. Water poured out, and then after a few seconds the hydrant sputtered air and quit. They had to get these men rinsed off immediately. But the gate to the launch complex was locked. No one had remembered to unlock it before abandoning the control center, and the trucks were parked on the other side of the fence. With help from some of the PTS technicians, the missile crew carried Hepstall and Malinger through the breakaway panel in the fence and placed them in the bed of a pickup. The crew drove to a nearby farmhouse and warned the occupants that deadly fumes were rising from the silo. Wong said to leave the area at once, and Frost asked to use their phone. Wessel found a garden hose in the backyard. After spraying the two airmen with water, they drove Hepstall and Malinger to the nearest hospital. A cloud of oxidizer floated from the launch complex, extending for about a mile and drifting toward the town of Rock, Kansas. The cloud looked like a dark, ominous thunderhead. Local residents didn't know what it was, and the cars and trucks on Highway 77 drove right through it. Air Force security police soon evacuated the roughly 200 inhabitants of Rock. Sergeant Thomas had been left behind, and none of the PTS crew members felt right about that. Even though he was gone, they thought, he shouldn't be lying down there alone. Two men volunteered to get him, Merle Linthicum, the team chief trainee, and Airman John G. Korzenko. They returned to the launch complex and put on Refco suits. Linthicum climbed into the escape hatch first, followed by Korzenko. Within seconds, Korzenko had climbed out. Oxidizer was leaking into his suit. Linthicum came back moments later. He wasn't getting enough air in his helmet. Another PTS team arrived from McConnell with fresh Refco suits and air packs. They wanted to get Thomas out, too. Airman Midland R. Jackson put on a Refco and climbed into the escape hatch. He came right back. His helmet was leaking. Jackson grabbed another helmet, tried the escape hatch again, and climbed the ladder all the way to the bottom in his Refco. But he'd never been in the escape hatch before, and the oxidizer was so thick down there he couldn't find the entrance to the control center. He climbed back up the ladder, frustrated, and yet determined not to quit. A few minutes later, Jackson and two other PTS technicians in Refcos, Technical Sergeant John C. Mock and Airman Michael L. Greenwell, tried to enter the control center through the access portal. They wandered underground through dense clouds of oxidizer, literally feeling their way down the stairs and through blast doors. They could not see more than a foot or so ahead, and had to stick together because none of their radios worked. They made it to the control center, found Sergeant Thomas on the floor, and carried his body onto the elevator. But no matter how many times they pushed the buttons, the elevator wouldn't work. They decided to carry Thomas up the stairs. His body was heavy, their suits felt heavy, and it was hot down there. After a few minutes, they couldn't carry him any farther and had to leave his body on the stairs. Two more PTS technicians in Refcos, Sergeant James Romig and Airman Gregory W. Anderson, went down and carried him, then had to quit because of the heat. The five men took turns going into the complex and carrying Thomas as far as they could. As soon as one group got tired, the other would step in. It took 2 hours to get Thomas up the stairs and out of the complex. An investigation of the accident later found the cause of the leak. Someone hadn't put a filter inside the oxidizer line. But the small rubber O-ring designed to hold the filter had been left inside the line. The O-ring blocked the poppet valve from closing fully, allowing oxidizer to pour out. Nobody accepted responsibility for failing to insert the filter. Oxidizer flowed more quickly without a filter in place, and someone may have deliberately omitted the filter to save time and load the tank quickly. The blast door leading to the control center wouldn't open because someone had propped open the blast door across from it with a bungee cord, and both doors couldn't be open at the same time. Hepstall had used the manual override to unlock blast door 8, and by entering the control center, he'd contaminated it with oxidizer. Robert J. Thomas was killed by a leak in his Refco, most likely at the spot where it intersected with the left glove. Oxidizer may have poured into the suit as he tried to reconnect the line to the missile. The Air Force recommended, in the future, that black vinyl electrical tape be used to seal the interface between the glove and the Refco suit more securely. Thomas left a widow and two young sons. Irby Hepstall died a week and a half later, at the age of 22, his lungs destroyed by oxidizer. His son had just turned 2. A small tear in the left leg of Hepstall's Refco suit, about 7/8 of an inch long, had allowed oxidizer to enter it. Carl Malinger had a stroke, went into a coma, suffered lung and kidney damage, lost the use of his left arm, and spent the next several months in the hospital. He'd enlisted to get training as an automobile mechanic, and his mother later felt enormous anger at the Air Force. Its report on the accident said that Hepstall and Malinger had failed to comply with Technical Order 21M LGM 25C 212, which states if disconnect starts to leak, screw disconnect to fully connected position immediately. The report suggested that Malinger, never trained for the task and working in a Titan II silo for the first time, was somehow to blame for what happened. General Curtis LeMay had created an institutional culture at the Strategic Air Command that showed absolutely no tolerance for mistakes. People were held accountable not only for their behavior, but for their bad luck. To err is human, everyone at the command had been told. To forgive is not SAC policy. Blaming young enlisted men for the accident at Rock, Kansas didn't eliminate the problems with the Titan II. The Pentagon had announced in 1967 that the Titan II was no longer needed and would be decommissioned, with the first missiles coming off alert in 1971. But every year the Air Force successfully battled to keep the Titan II. Its warhead was more than 7 times more powerful than the warhead carried by the Minuteman II. The United States had about 1,000 land-based missiles, and the 54 Titan IIs represented roughly 1/3 of their total explosive force. SAC didn't want to lose all that megatonnage without getting new weapons to replace it. As the Titan II aged, however, its ability to reach the Soviet Union became more uncertain. The last test launch of a Titan II occurred in 1976, and no more were planned due to a shortage of missiles and parts. When Senator Pryor and Skip Rutherford visited a Titan II site in Arkansas, the place looked impressive. But one of Rutherford's confidential sources later told him that there had been an oxidizer leak at a nearby launch complex that day, and that the vapor detectors in 13 of the state's 18 silos were broken. Pryor came up with a relatively inexpensive plan for protecting rural communities from fuel and oxidizer leaks at Titan II missile sites. Install a siren at every complex that would blare whenever the crew turned on the red warning beacon topside. The siren could easily be mounted on the same pole. It would warn neighboring homes and farms of a leak. The Air Force opposed the idea, arguing that a siren might cause people to leave areas of safety and evacuate into or through areas containing propellant fumes. Colonel Richard D. Osborne told Pryor that during those rare occasions when civilians needed to be alerted, the combined efforts of Air Force personnel and local law enforcement officers would ensure public safety. Pryor nevertheless decided to seek funding for the sirens through an amendment to a Senate bill. The Titan II missile wasn't the only Air Force weapon system having maintenance problems. Amid the defense cutbacks following the Vietnam War, the purchase of new planes and missiles had a much higher priority than buying spare parts for the old ones. During the late 1970s, on a typical day, anywhere from 1/2 to 2/3 of the Air Force's F-15 fighters were grounded for mechanical reasons. The Strategic Air Command had lost more than half of its personnel since 1961. Some of its B-52 bombers were 25 years old, and SAC's aura of invincibility had taken a beating. The highest-ranking officers in the Air Force tended to be bomber generals who'd risen through the ranks at SAC. And many of the pilots who flew bombing missions in Vietnam resented their insistence on rigid, centralized control. Tactics designed for executing the PSYOP proved ineffective during combat in Vietnam, where the targets were often mobile, and flying in a rigid formation could get you shot down. American pilots began to disobey orders, ignore their designated targets, bomb those that seemed more urgent, and lie about it in their reports. Chuck Horner, who flew more than 100 missions in Vietnam and later commanded the U.S. and Allied air campaign during the First Gulf War, resented the inflexible parent-child relationship that SAC's bomber generals often demanded. he felt a tremendous anger, shared by many other young officers, about how the Air Force leadership had behaved during the Vietnam War. I didn't hate them because they were dumb. I didn't hate them because they had spilled our blood for nothing. I hated them because of their arrogance, because they had convinced themselves that they actually knew what they were doing and that we were too minor to understand the big picture. I hated my own generals because they covered up their own gutless inability to stand up to the political masters in Washington and say, "Enough, this is bullshit. Either we fight or we go home." Horner vowed that he would never again be a part of something so insane and foolish. After the war, thousands of young officers left the Air Force, profoundly disillusioned. Many of those who stayed were determined to change things, and the influence of the Strategic Air Command gradually diminished as a younger generation of fighter generals who rejected centralization and standardization and rigid planning, who had first-hand experience in real combat and little interest in abstract theories about nuclear war, rose to power. During the years following the Vietnam War, anti-military sentiment in the United States became stronger, perhaps, than at any other time in the nation's history. Vietnam veterans were routinely depicted in books and films as racists, stoners, nutcases, and baby killers. Morale throughout the armed services suffered, and illegal drug use soared. By 1980, according to the Pentagon's own surveys, about 27% of all military personnel were using illegal drugs at least once a month. Marijuana was by far the most popular drug, although heroin, cocaine, and LSD were being used too. Among the armed services, the Marines had the highest rate of drug use. About 36% regularly smoked pot. About 32% of Navy personnel used marijuana at least once a month. The proportion of Army personnel was about 28%. The Air Force had the lowest rate, about 14%. It also had the most powerful warheads and bombs. The surveys by the Department of Defense most likely understated the actual amount of drug use. Random urine tests of more than 2,000 sailors at naval bases in Norfolk, Virginia, and San Diego, California, found that almost half had recently smoked pot. Although nuclear weapons and marijuana had recently become controversial subjects in American society, inspiring angry debates between liberals and conservatives, nobody argued that the two were a good combination. Donald Meyer served as a corporal with the 74th United States Field Artillery Detachment in Germany during the early 1970s. His detachment kept Pershing missiles on alert, ready to fire within 15 minutes. Each missile carried an atomic warhead 10 to 20 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. Meyer told the Milwaukee Journal that almost every one of the more than 200 men in his unit regularly smoked hashish. They were often high while handling secret documents and nuclear warheads. A survey found that one out of every 12 members of the United States Army in Germany was smoking hashish every day. "You get to know what you can handle," Meyer said. "Too much hash and you would ruin a good thing." At Homestead Air Force Base in Florida, 35 members of an Army unit were arrested for using and selling marijuana and LSD. The unit controlled the Nike Hercules anti-aircraft missiles on the base, along with their nuclear warheads. The drug use at Homestead was suspected after a fully armed Russian MiG-17 fighter plane, flown by a Cuban defector, landed there unchallenged while Air Force One was parked on a nearby runway. 19 members of an Army detachment were arrested on pot charges at a Nike Hercules base on Mount Gleason, overlooking Los Angeles. One of them had been caught drying a large amount of marijuana on land belonging to the U.S. Forest Service. Three enlisted men at a Nike Hercules base in San Rafael, California, were removed from guard duty for psychiatric reasons. One of them had been charged with pointing a loaded rifle at the head of a sergeant. Although illegal drugs were not involved in the case, the three men were allowed to guard the missiles, despite a history of psychiatric problems. The squadron was understaffed, and its commander feared that hippies, people from the Haight-Ashbury were trying to steal nuclear weapons. More than one-fourth of the crew on the USS Nathan Hale, a Polaris submarine with 16 ballistic missiles, were investigated for illegal drug use. 18 of the 38 seamen were cleared. The rest were discharged or removed from submarine duty. A former crew member of the Nathan Hale told a reporter that hashish was often smoked when the sub was at sea. The Polaris base at Holy Loch, Scotland, helped turn the Cowell Peninsula into a center for drug dealing in Great Britain. 9 crew members of the USS Casimir Pulaski, a Polaris submarine, were convicted for smoking marijuana at sea. One of the submarine tenders that docked at the base, the USS Canopus, often carried nuclear warheads and ballistic missiles. The widespread marijuana use among its crew earned the ship a local nickname, the USS Cannabis. 4 SAC pilots stationed at Castle Air Force Base near Merced, California, were arrested with marijuana and LSD. The police who raided their house, located off the base, said that it resembled a hippie-type pad with a picture of Ho Chi Minh on the wall. At Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro, North Carolina, 151 of the 225 security police officers were busted on marijuana charges. The Air Force Office of Special Investigations arrested many of them leaving the base's nuclear weapons storage area. Marijuana was discovered in one of the underground control centers of a Minuteman missile squadron at Malmstrom Air Force Base near Great Falls, Montana. It was also found in the control center of a Titan II launch complex about 40 miles southeast of Tucson, Arizona. The launch crew and security officers at the site were suspended while investigators tried to determine who was responsible for the 2 marijuana cigarettes. The true extent of drug use among American military personnel with access to nuclear weapons was hard to determine. Of the roughly 114,000 people who'd been cleared to work with nuclear weapons in 1980, only 1.5% lost that clearance because of drug abuse. But the Personnel Reliability Program's 98.5% success rate still allowed at least 1,728 unreliable drug users near the weapons. And those were just the ones who got caught. Before assuming command of the 308th Strategic Missile Wing at Little Rock Air Force Base, Colonel John Moser had supervised a major drug bust at Whiteman Air Force Base near Knobnostor, Missouri. More than 230 airmen were arrested for using and selling drugs there. Many were responsible for guarding and maintaining nuclear weapons. Some admitted to using marijuana, cocaine, and LSD on the job. 2 of the 3 officers who were arrested had highly sensitive jobs at the base. They entered target information into the guidance systems of Minuteman missiles. When Moser arrived at Little Rock to assume command of the 308th, another drug bust was unfolding. Marijuana had been found in the control center at a Titan II complex. But the arrests didn't end the drug use. The Strategic Air Command wasn't immune to larger social forces in an era before mandatory urine tests. Although launch officers rarely condoned illegal drug use, they sent alerts underground, without video cameras, to reveal what was happening throughout a launch site. Their ability to command and control had its limits. Every so often, PTS crews would sit outside at a Titan II complex, light up a joint, crack open a few beers, and unwind at the end of a long day. Henry Kissinger had tried to get rid of the Titan II. He considered the missile inaccurate and unreliable. It was a weapon system, he later explained, which the Pentagon had been wanting to scrap for years and I had kept in service for trading purposes. In 1972, while serving as the National Security Advisor to President Richard M. Nixon, Kissinger had offered a deal to the Soviet Union. The United States would decommission its Titan II missiles if the Soviets agreed to retire their SS-9 missiles. The deal would eliminate a powerful threat to Moscow, and the Soviet missile was similar in a number of respects to the Titan II, employing the same type of fuel and oxidizer. but the SS-9 was also newer, larger, and capable of delivering a much heavier payload. The Soviet Union declined the offer. The Nixon administration was stuck with the Titan II, getting rid of 54 ballistic missiles without getting anything in return from the Soviets made little sense in the midst of an arms race. The failed attempt to decommission an aging weapon system reflected the new balance of power. Robert McNamara had assumed that once the Soviet Union felt confident about its ability to destroy the United States in any nuclear exchange, it would stop building new missiles. But the Soviets didn't share McNamara's faith in mutually assured destruction. After the humiliation of the Cuban Missile Crisis, one of their diplomats had told an American counterpart, "You Americans will never be able to do this to us again." In a rivalry where a nation's power was measured numerically in warheads and bombs, the Soviet Union now sought to gain the upper hand. Within a decade of removing strategic weapons from Cuba, the Soviet Union increased the number of its long-range land-based missiles from about 56 to more than 1,500. Its arsenal of submarine-based missiles rose from about 72 to almost 500. By the early 1970s, the Soviets had more long-range missiles than the United States. An elaborate anti-ballistic missile system had been created to defend Moscow, and a network of underground bunkers had been constructed beneath the city to protect the leadership of the Communist Party. Linked by secret subway lines, the bunkers could house thousands of people. Although the United States possessed fewer ballistic missiles than the Soviet Union, it still had more nuclear weapons. McNamara had imposed a limit on the number of missiles that the United States would deploy, but not on the number of warheads that each missile could carry. Before leaving office, he'd approved the development of multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles, MIRVs. Publicly justified as a method of overwhelming a Soviet anti-ballistic missile system, adding more warheads to a single missile was less expensive than building more missiles. MIRVs also increased the number of Soviet targets that the United States could destroy in a first strike. The Minuteman III missile, introduced in 1970, carried three warheads. They were housed on a post-boost vehicle, nicknamed the Bus, that had its own rockets and guidance system. The Bus separated from the missile and released each warhead over a different target, delivering them one after another, like a school bus dropping off children after school. The Poseidon missile, first deployed on American submarines in 1971, could carry 14 warheads. Kissinger was considered one of America's leading authorities on nuclear strategy. For more than a decade, his writing had helped to shape the national debate on the subject. He had served as an advisor to the Kennedy administration during the Berlin crisis. He knew as much as any civilian about the competing theories of nuclear warfare. And yet Kissinger was astonished by his first formal briefing on the PSYOP. The smallest attack option would hit the Soviet Union with almost 2,000 weapons, the largest with more than 3,000. The vast scale and inflexibility of the PSYOP led Kissinger to describe it as a horror strategy. At a national security meeting in the Situation Room of the White House, he later wondered how one rationally could make a decision to kill 80 million people. President Nixon was equally appalled. Most of the targets in the PSYOP were still part of the Soviet war machinery: missile sites, air bases, command centers, ports. But the desire for assured destruction of the Soviet economy inspired calculations that made Fred Eakley's theories about urban bombing seem like a relic of the Stone Age. Rand had developed a computer model to provide speedy estimates of the casualties and deaths that would be caused by different nuclear attacks. It was called Quick Count. The types of weapons to be used in an attack, their targets, the prevailing winds, and the density of the local population were entered into an IBM 7090 computer, and then Quick Count produced graphs, charts, and summaries of the potential carnage. It predicted the consequences of various attacks, not only on the Soviet Union, but also on Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and the United States. And it included, as a bonus, an urban DGZ selector that helped war planners maximize the destruction of cities, allowing them to select the desired ground zeros likely to kill the most people. A government report later outlined the obstacle course to recovery that victims of such nuclear attacks would have to navigate. Time after attack, 1 to 2 days. Attack effect, blast and thermal. 2 to 20 days, lethal fallout. 2 to 7 days, trapped, no medical treatment. 5 to 50 days, life support inadequacies, food, water, shelter. 2 weeks to 1 year, epidemics and diseases. 1 to 2 years, economic breakdown. 5 to 20 years, late radiation effects. 10 to 50 years, ecological effects. 2 to several generations, genetic effects. Although the human toll would be grim, the authors of the report were optimistic about the impact of nuclear detonations on the environment. No weight of nuclear attack, which is at all probable, could induce gross changes in the balance of nature that approach in type or degree the ones that human civilization has already inflicted on the environment, it said. These include cutting most of the original forests, tilling the prairies, irrigating the deserts, damming and polluting the streams, eliminating certain species and introducing others, overgrazing hillsides, flooding valleys, and even preventing forest fires. The implication was that nature might find nuclear warfare a relief. Kissinger had once thought that Western Europe could be defended with tactical nuclear weapons, confining the damage to military targets and avoiding civilian casualties. But that idea now seemed inconceivable, and the refusal of America's NATO allies to build up their conventional forces ensured that a military conflict with the Soviet Union would quickly escalate beyond control. During a meeting in the White House Situation Room, Kissinger complained that NATO nuclear policy insists on our destruction before the Europeans will agree to defend themselves. Nixon's administration soon found itself in much the same position as Kennedy's, urgently seeking alternatives to an all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union. I must not be, and my successors must not be, limited to the indiscriminate mass destruction of enemy civilians as the sole possible response, President Nixon told Congress. Phrases like flexible response and graduated escalation and pauses for negotiation seemed relevant once again, as Kissinger asked the Joint Chiefs of Staff to develop plans for limited nuclear war. But the Joint Chiefs still balked at making changes to the PSYOP and resisted any civilian involvement in target selection. The debacle in Vietnam had strengthened their belief that once the United States entered a war, the military should determine how to fight it. When Kissinger visited the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command to discuss nuclear war plans, General Bruce K. Holloway, the head of SAC, deliberately hid certain aspects of the PSYOP from him. The details about specific targets were considered too important and too secret for Kissinger to know. The Pentagon's reluctance to allow civilian control of the PSYOP was prompted mainly by operational concerns. A limited attack on the Soviet Union might impede the full execution of the PSYOP and provoke an immediate all-out retaliation by the Soviets. A desire to fight humanely could bring annihilation and defeat. More important, the United States still didn't have the technological or administrative means to wage a limited nuclear war. A 1968 report by the Weapons Systems Evaluation Group said that within 5 to 6 minutes of launching a submarine-based missile, the Soviet Union could, with a high degree of confidence, kill the President of the United States, the Vice President, and the next 14 successors to the Oval Office. The worldwide military command and control system had grown to encompass 8 warning systems, 60 communications networks, 100 command centers, and 70,000 personnel. But the ground stations for its early warning satellites could easily be destroyed by conventional weapons or sabotage, eliminating the ability to detect Soviet missile launches. The National Emergency Airborne Command Post, a converted Boeing 747 designed to take off, whisk the president away from Washington safely, and permit the management of nuclear warfare in real time, did not have a computer. The officers manning the plane would have to record information about a Soviet attack by hand, and the entire command and control system could be shut down by the electromagnetic pulse and the transient radiation effects of a nuclear detonation above the United States. Communications might be impossible for days after a Soviet attack. The system had already proven unreliable in conditions far less demanding than a nuclear war. In 1967, during the Six-Day War, urgent messages warning the USS Liberty to remain at least 100 miles off the coast of Israel were mistakenly routed to American bases in the Philippines, Morocco, and Maryland. The spy ship was attacked by Israeli planes almost 2 days after the first urgent warning was sent, and never received. The following year, when the USS Pueblo was attacked by North Korean forces, its emergency message calling for help took more than 2 hours to pass through the WWMCCS bureaucracy and reach the Pentagon. The American naval commander in Japan who managed to contact the Pueblo couldn't establish direct communications with the Pentagon, the Situation Room at the White House, or commanders in the Pacific whose aircraft might have defended the ship. During a conflict with the Soviet Union, messages would have to be accurately relayed within moments of an attack. A decade after the Kennedy administration recognized the problem, despite the many billions of dollars that had been spent to fix it, the command and control system of the United States was still incapable of managing a nuclear war. A more accurate appraisal, a top-secret WSEG study concluded in 1971, would seem to be that our warning assessment, attack assessment, and damage assessment capabilities are so limited that the president may well have to make PSYOP execution decisions virtually in the blind, at least so far as real-time information is concerned. A few years later, another top-secret report said that the American response to a nuclear attack would be imperfect, poorly coordinated, and